What we want to do today, in the brief amount of time that we have an hour this morning and an hour this afternoon, is to just clip an excerpt out of a larger series on this whole business of group work. I'd emphasize that right from the very beginning. This is simply an excerpt. It is not intended as a whole. Actually, in terms of the series of lectures that are delivered at the Youth Workers Conference, what I will touch on this morning and this afternoon are the meetings, the sections, or the lectures 4 and 5. I'm completely aware of the fact that these build on 1, 2, and 3, but we have only 2 hours in which to work. So we're going to touch on a few high spots, hope to stimulate your interest somewhat so that you carry on by yourself. We are not going to be able to give you a total picture of group work. This would be rather presumptuous on my part and naive on your part if you were to accept it. So let's talk this morning briefly about this matter of what is it that makes for a group. We always talk about groups and about group work, but really, what are some of the factors that enter into the making of a group? For example, here at the present time, do we have a group? Not necessarily so. So, looking at some of these factors, the first one that we have is a very simple one, and that's the one of spatial proximity. This is something that at first seems to be almost ridiculously simple, but something that is really quite important, especially insofar as this conference is concerned with Walther League work. There is such a thing as having too small a number in too much space to have a group. For example, if we had the confines of this room and had a half a dozen Walther Leaguers meeting, let's say in an executive session, and there are as many chairs as you have at the present time, where are they going to sit? As often as not, you'll have a situation, one will sit there, one here, one there, and scatter around. With too much spread and not enough spatial proximity, you cannot weld a group together. Incidentally, this is a good reason why, also it's a very fruitful suggestion, if working in church and you have, for example, Lenten services or something of the sort where the attendance is lesser than on a regular Sunday morning, under some guise or other, fact or fiction, block off the back half dozen rows. Pull the group together near the front and closer together. You'll be surprised at the difference in the psychological impact on the group as opposed to just letting them scatter all over the church. As you notice, and this is one of the things I always remember at the SEM, that when you sit down for chapel, the chapel is full, and when the singing begins, there's this full thrust coming out of the assembled congregation. There's a big difference between this, taking the, I don't know, what is the SEM chapel seat, let's say 600, something like that, gathered together in a close group, physically close, and taking that same 600 and putting them in the someday-to-be-completed Valpo Chapel, spreading them around and attempting to have them sing there. Somehow you just don't have that same feeling. And this is what we are talking about, that there are psychological factors that are functioning in group work. The one we're talking about here is this psychological feeling of togetherness that is based in part simply on spatial proximity. You have to have sufficient spatial proximity to permit intimate face-to-face contact. What's the old gag that even the kindergarten teacher uses? That's the old gag that if little Johnny is yak-yakking here in the whole cluster, she continues her whole presentation, just takes Johnny by the hand, and leads him over a half a dozen chairs to sit all by himself, even if he's broken off from the group by only 2 or 3 chairs. What she has done is to break little Johnny's spatial continuity with the rest of those sitting about him. She has, in a sense, removed him from the group, even though he's still very much in contact with the group in terms of the confines of the room. She has taken him out of this intimate little cluster, which he is choosing to exploit, and placed him in a position where his only contact is with her. This works also with regard to Walther League. By the same token, you have to have enough room, enough space to allow some movement within the group. Actually, I suppose we would have to say, just looking at the group here, this is not a good setting for any kind of group work. Now, I realize there are circumstances that dictated this arrangement, but this is not the good setting that you have right here. You are a little bit too much jammed in for any type of activity. And what does this promote? Promotes the type of thing that has not yet stopped in the group. And that is the underlying little mumble. Because you find yourself somewhat like sardines in a can, and those sardines can't squawk, you can. And you get just a little bit of this underlying. These are the people who are not with this that we have going on at the present time. So, number one, remember the importance of spatial proximity, and yet not so close together that you defeat your purpose. Number two, there has to be a continuity in time. And this, perhaps, if we wanted to start off immediately with an illustration from this gathering, is that the only ones who are actually participating in this group in terms of the whole conference proceedings are those who attend regularly. The occasional Isaac Waltons and others who fish part-time during this conference and otherwise bum the session simply are not with this. They are getting nothing from it. They are receiving very little. There has to be a continuity in time and ongoing contact. Now, let's relate this to a specific Walter League situation. Actually, when you begin talking Walter League work, how many hours out of a month do those Walter Leaguers really see each other in terms of intimate face-to-face contact? How many hours are they together within the society, and including its allied activities? And how many hours do they see each other outside of the activities of the society? And if you begin toting these up even with a quick judgment, you'll soon see this, that actually Walter League work in a congregation has one strike against it in this respect. You do not have sufficient continuity in time to do that which you would like to do. Hence, you're somewhat stuck with the second best. Let's apply it also to another situation. In terms of planning your Walter League program, there is nothing that so defeats the Walter League meeting based on this importance of continuity in time as the chairman, who simply says, well, now we'd like to talk about a social activity for this month. And then nothing. And pretty soon what happens to the group? A little pocket breaks off here with the discussion, a little pocket here, a little pocket there. And in terms of the ongoing work of the group, it stops. What has happened in this particular instance is that the chairman has tossed out something, but has brought nothing after it. Either by way of a suggestion or simply by way of saying, we'd like to talk about a social activity for this month. George, how about an idea from you? Jane, you tossed something on the floor. What do you happen to be thinking about? This is where you get this break in time. By the way, this works also in preaching. What is the thing that bothers you about the man who begins preaching and says, the message of Easter must always be borne in mind by all of us throughout the whole year? Now, what is happening here? Who built this fire? Somebody from the Wisconsin Synod with no Boy Scouts. You're going to get a boost, I think. Good, thank you. I would appreciate that. What has happened in this sermon illustration that I gave you was this, that you see the person has, in the course of preaching, broken an expected continuity of presentation. He has staggered this and left gaps, and you find yourself somewhat doing this mentally as you listen to this preacher. Come on, let's have the rest of it. But it doesn't come. Now, the same thing holds true with regard to group activity. Unless there is a steady progression of activity, a continuity in time of activity, your group will begin to disintegrate slowly. Now, in terms of sitting down then with an executive board and planning a program, this means that you must instruct and encourage your executive board to set up a program that operates steadily, consistently. Now, of course, beware of the other obvious extreme of setting up a rigid minute-by-minute type of thing, something like a television or radio script where everything is set down even in terms of seconds. But be sure that in terms of your social activity, as well as in your formal meetings, you do have this continuity. Incidentally, I'm going to mention a number of things here and then pull them all together in terms of an example, in terms of a given meeting. Three, it's most important to consider the goal orientation of the group. And by goal orientation, we mean basically this. For what purpose does the group exist? With what thoughts in mind? Now, let's take this group again. In terms of the formal planning of this particular organization and this particular gathering here today, the goal orientation, the formal goal orientation, is, I think perhaps we can call it this, a Walter League orientation conference. At least let's just say that. But does everyone share this goal orientation? What about the married fellows that saw here again a three-day bachelor only? And what about the fellows who see this simply as an opportunity for a little outing, away from the family? What about those who see this simply as an opportunity to get away from classes? What about those who see this simply as an opportunity to lounge around by the lake? And this is something that you will find also within your Walter League work, or for that matter with regard to any kind of group work, that not everybody will share the same goal orientation. This means that you will have both major, and perhaps we can call this the formal orientation of the total group, and you will also have a number of minor and hence competing orientations. When you get the person in the Walter League Society who is there simply as an occasion and as an opportunity to meet somebody else, a girl to meet a fella, a girl to meet a girlfriend, a fella to meet his buddy, a fella to meet a girl, something of the sort, this person is actually competing against you, now as the counselor, as the pastor, who is working in terms of, let's say, the Walter League Star, with the... $50,000-$60,000. It's getting to the point where in terms of a single service, the church is crowded. Now I said a single service. And it is true that since the new pastor came fresh from the seminary, he has pointed out repeatedly that there are a number of deficiencies in the church building. But as the members see it, number one, this building is still definitely sound, and they can back this up with concrete evidence. Number two, they're still paying for it. I'm glad you're listening carefully. Number two, they are still paying for this. They're in the hole on it. Number three, they say, why not two services? Besides, I'd like to go in an early service in the summer and so forth. Number three, they're not completely convinced that this young squirt knows all there is to know about church work, services, and the like anyway. So you come through and you succeed perhaps in getting a building or expansion program going, but you don't have everybody with you. This is what you, when you have a low, and this happens in Walter League activity. For instance, at the present time, I think I would dare say that in some societies, the current Big M program of Walter League is experiencing this. Common understanding and expectations, and it's really rolling along. In others, and we won't worry about why, you've got this. Which group, given equal number, equal circumstances, and so forth, which group is going to show the greater results in this project? Obviously, this group. Now, you will also have this, and this is the thing you want to avoid. This is the ideal, number one, and you're never going to completely realize it. This is what you want to work for. You're going to have some up, some down. But above all, this is what you want to avoid. And that's this type of thing. This is where you get your group at the beginning of the meeting. And by dint of your personality, perhaps your presentation or the program that you have, by the end of the meeting, you've got this gang really fired. And they're all set to go. But the meeting ends, and in the next 30 days before the next Walter League meeting, everything just plain peters out. And you shoot back up again and down. This is the spurt type of thing. The 1 hour or 2 hour, depending on the length of the meeting, the 1 or 2 hour Walter League spurt, and then youth work in the congregation dies until the next Walter League meeting. Spurts and dies, spurts and dies.
Now, how are we going to correct this, or how are you particularly going to be able to work with this? And this is where we'd like to suggest this type of thing. If you've got this, in a sense, you've got the same thing as if you have a tree that is bent over. How are you going to correct this? You're going to correct this by slowly pulling the tree back. Remember that you are working with a group that, in a sense, is every bit as important. I should say you're working with a number of people who are every bit as important to the group as you are. I think perhaps Reverend Westling's comments this morning. The fact that you are the counselor or the pastor in a Walter League group, so what? So you're not the big chief. Perhaps the most important person in the Walter League group is no one. No single individual, but the individual tied together in a group relationship. This is where what you want to do is slowly bend back, always being very careful to avoid this type of thing, that you snap it off, that you snap off the tree. Now, when you break off the tree, you are not going to get these kids to just up and quit the league. Why not? This isn't socially nice. And besides, their parents will object, and they'll become objects, perhaps, of indirect ridicule and scorn within the congregation and the like. But what you get are a number of attenders, bench warmers, that could perhaps do more if they would just sit there and hatch eggs. They're contributing nothing at all to the group. They're there. But in a sense, their tacit presence is actually a detriment to the work of the group. This is what we mean by common expectations and understanding and being careful of it. Perhaps another thing that's intensely important, this is what, five, something like that? Is bearing in mind that every group has a system of role and status within it. And this is perhaps one of the biggest bugaboos that faces the young person. And when I say young person, I'm thinking not of age, but I'm thinking by way of actual experience. The young person who gets into a situation and has preceded his presence in that situation with a lot of specialized training. He's now working with a lot of people who have not had the blessings and the opportunities of that specialized training. And he knows where he wants that group to go. Now you see, I'm harking back to goal orientation, expectations, understandings, and the like. And he proceeds to just ram it right straight through. Let me cite it this way. Our research group did a job in one of the major Midwest cities on a congregation. And we found that that was in the men's club. There was a problem there. This is the pastor told him. He said, I'm just not getting along with the men's club. He said, at a time, this is one of the outstanding organizations within the church, and at the present time, it's just bogged down. And yet, he said, I don't know what's wrong, and I've had any number of members come to me and ask, Pastor, what's wrong with our men's club? Well, after a number of interviews, all of which are quite confidential, we discovered this, that the man who had formerly been president of the men's club, he was now out of office about a year, lived right next door to the pastor. He was a businessman who could frequently take off during the day because of the nature of his business. He was a very competent leader, had done an outstanding job as president of the men's club. The newly elected man was perhaps equally competent. However, he lived a great distance away from both the church and the pastor, and that his major contact with the pastor was either by phone, only in the early evening hours when he was home and the pastor was in meeting, or on Sunday after church, or at the men's club meeting itself. So what the pastor frequently did in order to get the ball rolling, and quite often because the pastor was unable to attend every men's club meeting, he would say to the ex-president, "Hey, Charlie, I can't make it tonight. You seem to see him around the dinner hall, right next door. I can't make it to meeting tonight. I've been thinking about so-and-so. Would you mention this to the group?" Which Charlie very faithfully did. But what happened here was that the president of the group was being completely bypassed by the pastor in going to the group. He was being bypassed in the person of Charlie. The president was peeved about this. All right, it's small potatoes. But don't tell me you have never been peeved when you were bypassed. And remember your victories sometimes. The president was seeing some of this. And what he did was just kind of sit tight. He didn't buck the pastor, but he put a little glue into the mechanism and slowed things down. This is what we mean. In an organization, in a Walter Lee Society or any organization, be it the parish, be it a business organization or anything else, if you've got officers, and these officers have been elected by the group from the floor, by all means follow the chain of command. There is nothing that will cut you off as quickly by those who are supposed to give you the greatest amount of help as if you get up and bypass. Let's use a real simple example. The president, perhaps the secretary, are at the front of the group. The president is conducting the meeting. The meeting is going on, discussion. And the president even asks, Pastor, would you comment on this matter? The pastor gets up off his chair, walks to the front, and he says, well, kids, turns his back completely on the president. The simplest thing that you can do in avoiding yourself an awful lot of trouble is address your remarks, Mr. Chairman. Or Madam Chairman, go through the chain of command. And if you think that this is unnecessary or silly, think of yourself. Here you are, pastor of the congregation. And along comes the circuit visitor. And he's no better than you are, especially if you ask you. And here comes the circuit visitor along. He wants to visit the congregation, so he says, nothing at all, short circuit visitor. So he says, nothing at all to you. All of a sudden, he shows up at a voters' meeting one night, and the chairman announces to the voters who are assembled there, I've had a call from Pastor Schmidt, our circuit visitor. He's asked to speak to the voters this evening on a very important matter. A matter of encouragement by way of communion and church attendance, evangelism, or something of the sort. Pastor Schmidt, would you take over, please? And what do you think as the pastor? And I can tell you what you're going to think. How do you like that? That dirty dog. Didn't even have the courtesy to give me a phone call. Nothing of the sort. Just came hamming right in here. I don't care what Pastor Schmidt says. Even if he paraphrases St. Paul, you're going to find things wrong with what he says. Why? Because you have been peeved, you see. He did not follow the chain of command. This is a ridiculously simple thing, isn't it? But as long as you are possessed at least partially of the old Adam and your leader, you had better work with this or you're going to be in trouble. Now, we've talked about groups. How many can you have in a group? I'll tell you right now, this is too large a group to work with. Because this is the rule of thumb. A number of psychological experiments have been conducted, and we can show you these in a number of ways. One of the simplest ways it's done in the university is to take an individual and put them in what looks like an elongated telephone booth. And so that everything is blotted out, top, side, bottom, except for a wall about 3 or 4 feet away, and which are a number of very tiny in terms of narrow and about 3-inch tall light spaces. There are lights behind this little crack. And these are lights. 1, 2, 3, 4. And the individual is asked to tell, when can't you see all of them at the same time? Now, I'll try it just briefly here. Unfortunately, mostly here. Now, we'll look at these marks. I want you to look at all of them at the same time. Not this, and not with your eyes scanning them. Most of you are out of it by now, by the way. Anybody who thinks he's still in it is lying. Because it has been found that the most that the human, call it optic machinery connected with the brain, this and that and everything else, can grasp and hold at a single glance is 7. And this applies not only to the eye, but also to the mental capacities involved. Hence, in terms of organization, this is the ideal organization, and also the pattern upon which most U.S. corporations are built, that you'll have one top person, president, chairman of the board, or something, and 7. Under, see, this is all under this one person. Then under this one, you can have 7 more. 10. If you have a Walter Lake Society composed of 50 people, suppose you've got 50 in the group, and here is the counselor, here's the president, and you have a combination secretary-treasurer, and that represents the total officers. What's the maximum number they can handle? How many? 21, yes. You're just overboard on this type of thing. The most that you can handle at one time are 7. Hence, the thing that we're pointing out here is that a group must be organized. And don't kid yourself in this respect that you say, well, now our group is brand new, we've just started, we have only 17 members in our little league, we've only started 2 months ago. I would suggest that perhaps for a beginning, we do not elect any officers, any series of officers, that we simply appoint a chairman from the group for the first year. Psychologically, you are giving this chairman an impossible task, even if you work very, very intimately with this person. 7 is your optimum number, multiples of seven, your optimum number for any group with which you can work effectively. And we'll talk about the difference between effective and efficient, between being effective and being efficient a little later on. Now, a few other considerations with regard to the group. It's necessary that a group have sentiment, have feeling. This is the situation that we have. In the period prior to World War II, you've got to be careful with your numbers nowadays. In the period prior to World War II, about 38, 39, what was the general attitude in the United States with regard to a man in the armed forces?
An enlisted man in the armed forces.
Well, it's nice that this no-good bum went into the army. It's obvious he couldn't hold any other kind of respectable job, but at least he isn't living off of social welfare. He's going in the army and made himself available for cannon fodder. What was wrong here? And by the way, what was the morale situation? You have no way of recalling this, perhaps you've read. What was the morale situation in the army in 1938? Very, very poor. AWOL was never, ever higher. It was never higher, even in the heat of the most intense battle, than it was in the pre-World War II period. This is because the sentiment of the group, in this case the population of the United States, thought ill of this particular type of activity. After Pearl Harbor, at the end of 41, the beginning of 42, what about this? Men who made tens of thousands of dollars a year went into the army. Were they thought to be stupid or foolish? This was considered patriotic, wonderful, glorious. The man who was making, who said, I've been in the army for 3 years, I think I'm going to make a career out of it, was not regarded as a no-good bum, but was regarded in a certain patriotic frame of reference. This is the man that is defending our homeland, our wives and children, our property. This was a man that was important to the country because there had been a change of circumstance. What I want to illustrate here is simply this thought. You've got to consider the group sentiment, which is influenced by the total environment in which your group operates. For example, let's take the situation that is now more publicized in New York City, this business of gang warfare. They're getting publicity now like they never had before. If the Walls could get that much publicity, it'd really be on top of the world. Let's take the situation you have in New York with the gang war situation there. What about this? What brought this on, this idea of, what's the expression they use for their own little kingdom? Turf, that's right. What brought this on, this business of dividing up the area into our turf and defending it against all else? Was it simply because there weren't enough playgrounds or enough of this? What you have existing at the present time is a total sentiment that is being manifested in what we feel is a most unhealthy way. But to these kids, the defense of their turf is the most logical thing under the sun. Now, take a Walterly situation. If you've got a total sentiment that the Walter League is, now let's take a beginning Walter League again. It just started, and this is the way you set it up. And you set it up from the very beginning as basically, and 99% so, a social gathering. I can tell you right now that as this sentiment begins to take hold, you're kidding yourself if you think, well, in 6 months, we'll move into this business of worship. In 6 months, we'll get active in more of Walter League International's work. Either you get started with a total sentiment that is conducive to the total program of Walter League, or you will never be able to add it. See, what we're saying here is this. If you're going to have a Walter League group, it is every bit as easy, psychologically, sociologically, and every other way, to start with a group whose total sentiment reflects all of the Walter League program, as it is to start any other way. In fact, it is more difficult, because you see, this is what you're happening. This is where you're starting, I'm assuming, a four-point major breakdown. It doesn't particularly connote to anything. But let's suppose you start a Walter League group with no breakdown, strictly social. And then you come along and you say, kids, I tell you, there's something that we've been somewhat overlooking. I think we ought to begin introducing this, giving a lot of thought to it. And that's that every meeting, in the course of our meeting, we allot a fixed amount of time and definitely set it aside and preserve this for, let's say, topic study. You don't have any more total time, do you? So you do this. And what has happened? In terms of that which you have taught the group in the beginning, you are now cheating them of part of that which you have encouraged from the beginning. As you get into worship, other activities, you begin cheating additionally on the social. But already you're cheating on something you introduced just a few months ago. And this is where you get a psychological rebellion. Perhaps one of the greatest mistakes that can be made in terms of working with the group, and I'm working on the assumption that a number of you are going to be in new congregations, or relatively young congregations, perhaps starting Walter League work, is that you can start out on a shoestring program. We'll get the kids here by having strictly social. We'll open with the Lord's Prayer and then make a beeline for the pool table. And after a few hot games, we'll close with the benediction. Now, you're kidding yourself if you think over a period of months, you can develop this into a healthy, well-balanced Walter League program and Walter League society. This is what we mean by sentiment and its effect in this particular instance. Now, in terms of activity, every group has to have activity, and we talked about this in terms of a continuity of time. By all means, in considering your Walter League work, also consider this. How many members of the Walter League Society that are present are indeed participating members of that Walter League Society? This is just a slightly fancier way than saying, watch out for dead wood. Because the only thing dead wood can do is burn a little and smoke a lot, but it doesn't produce much of anything. And it might be well for you as a counselor or as a director of the Walter League or whatever particular position you have, to simply come along and keep your eye open. Why is this individual not participating, though present, or this one, or that? Chances are you're going to have this type of thing, where you have a hardcore group. And then you're going to have the friends here. And then you're going to have the occasional member. It's a member, but the occasional sitter-inner. In terms of a congregation, I suppose you would say these are the faithful church attenders, contributors, and the like. The next group are those that you can count on at least once, probably twice a month. And in certain respects, here are your Christmas and Easter members. They don't stay away enough for you to really put the screws on them, but they're not present enough for you to really count on them either. You're going to have this situation. Because this, too, is a part of human nature. Now, look out for it in the sense of being aware of it. Because there is nothing so tragic as the naive counselor or pastor who counts up how many members do I have on my list, regardless of the devious ways by which he got them there. How many members do I have on my list? And then sits down, let's take an example here with the building committee. He says, men, we've got 517 communicant members. I've checked, and we find that we have in our congregation 211 families. Now, we want to build a new church and raise so much money. I feel that we can reasonably expect an annual contribution of $300 per family. Yeah, you can expect that kind of an average if all of the families are with you. And the same thing with the Walter Lee type of program. You've got to bear in mind also these factors. Another item, one more item and one more footnote then, please. This. By all means, it is important that the counselor, the pastor, recognize the standard of norms that exist within the group. You are going to be working with Walter League societies as a pastor. If you do not conduct yourself in a way that is compatible with the way in which your league members conceive of a pastor, you're going to be at odds with them. Let's take this. Here is a hypothetical situation. This entire group is invited to be the guest of the President of the United States for lunch. That's all you're told, such and such a day. You all get dressed up, fit and polished, and you show up. And in walks the President of the United States in Bermuda shorts. What'd you laugh for? Why did you particularly laugh about this? You wear Bermuda shorts, don't you? Well, in some instances, it might be for the general. In some instances, it might be for the general welfare of the community if it didn't, but at any rate, you do. Now, you find this rather incongruous. You do not conceive, in general, of the President of the United States attending even a luncheon to which he has invited a number of guests and appearing in a pair of Bermuda shorts and an old sweatshirt. By the same token, remember that with regard to your Walter League Society, and this is where we talk about this thing again, you are, whether you like it or not, and I deliberately say that, are the pastor of the congregation. Remember always to conduct yourself as such. Let's take it this way. What about in terms of dress? Are you a Walter Leaguer? No, not strictly speaking. Are you a teenager? At least not chronologically. You are the pastor of the congregation. For you to come into this group now, having affected what may be a highly popular teenage haircut and style of dress, is totally incongruous with the expectations of this particular group. You become no longer the accepted and respected person in the group. You become literally an oddball. What about in terms of working with some of the members of the group? Again, the same thing must be borne in mind in your conduct. Perhaps the worst thing that can be done for breaking down a status system, and you'll pay for it later by way of a direct or indirect rebellion, is for you to come in as pastor and say, now look, kid, we all want to be friends. Just call me Bill. Well, they know better than that. You're the called pastor of the congregation. The fact that they refer to you as pastor, the fact that they refer to you perhaps as reverend, does not indicate they don't like you. In fact, this is a very convenient way for them to indicate, number one, their like for you, and at the same time, their like for you as you stand in relation to them. There is such a thing as too much intimacy completely breaking down the status system. And when you break the status system down, The higher you were in the beginning, the farther you fall in the end. Now, just one other footnote, please, and we'll have time perhaps for a couple of questions. We talked about this business of efficient and effective. Remember, this is not the same thing. In terms of Walter League counseling, in terms of our congregational work, there's a big difference between the man that is efficient and the man that is effective. The efficient man perhaps succeeds in setting up a terrific organization. And getting this organization set up, it functions beautifully. This is the type of man, perhaps the pastor. By the way, this applies to pastors too. That a letter comes down from 210 North Broadway, for instance, something that is relatively a new incident, and these are these newsletters that come down to pastors. These come down to the pastor, and this is asked to be channeled to the proper person. He just walks over to his sheet and he says, let's see who's the person for this. Yes, sir, John Jones, there you are. This man is fantastically efficient. He's got his congregation organized tremendously so. And it's possible to do this with the Walter League, that they practically all sit there and the chairman has the gavel raised as the sweep second hand comes around to 8 o'clock and says, bang, the meeting will come to order. Now, well, you've got to admit it's efficient. But even though it may be efficient, how effective is it? I'm sure that you can think of a number of people in the clergy, out of the clergy, who are tremendously efficient and yet don't seem to get anything out of other people. If I'm talking too loud, you can tell me I don't want to be rude. There are a lot of people that are like this, are very, very good at handling a situation. They handle it terrifically on paper, but they get nothing out of the group. And this is something that you've got to pay attention to, too. Sometimes you run into the man that is a total bumbler. He stumbles all over the place, and you've perhaps seen this sometimes in a pastor. He cannot conduct a worship service without fumbling someplace, losing his page in a book, stumbling over the words, hemming and hawing left and right. And yet, in terms of pastoral work, this man is almost fantastically effective. What I want to emphasize is simply this. Do not be overly impressed by your efficiency. You may be the most efficient Walter League counselor that ever came out of God's creative hand. But unless you are quite effective, you are actually more of a detriment to your society than an asset. Now, I'm not saying concern yourself only with being effective and ignore efficiency. What I'm saying is that you must consider both ends of the continuum and set yourself up and work towards a happy medium on this. Now, suppose for the few minutes that we have left, just a couple minutes that we have left, we toss it open for your comments, questions, objections, or anything of the sort that you may care to raise. Yes, sir?
We're talking about the role of a pastor. What about him playing basketball, baseball, taking care of the conducting games and such? Wouldn't this bring him down a bit?
I don't have the slightest idea. That depends on the group with which you are working. What is possible with this group and fits in beautifully with their conception of the pastor does not fit here at all. For example, at Trinity Church, at my congregation, I consistently wear the clerical collar. This has become a part of the expectations and understanding of those people. At Trinity Church, in terms of the conducting of the worship service, we wear the cassock all the time. For Holy Communion, we wear the alb and the amice and the chasuble. This fits in just like this at that place. I come from northern Michigan. When I hit the city limits, I take off my clerical collar, even though it's my mother I'm going to visit. It just doesn't fit with her. So your question, to play basketball or not, I think the answer to that would depend on, first of all, determining what kind of a group do you have? What are their expectations? Now, I would add this. The fact that you determine their expectations does not mean that these expectations cannot be modified over a period of time. But there is no one-to-one answer to your question. So I am neither encouraging you to play or discouraging you. I'm emphasizing a sensitivity to this business of expectations and understanding. This afternoon, we'd like to pick it up, not necessarily following on the basis of what we said this morning, but again, another chapter with somewhat excerpting out of a total whole. This afternoon, we'd like to concentrate on some of the functional roles of the leader in the group. Now, in this particular instance, we'll be speaking of the leader in a number of terms. The leader both in the sense of you as the pastoral leader, and the leader also in the sense of the president of the local society, or the chairman of a committee, or whatever the situation may happen to be. In many instances, we can take the role of the leader and divide it up into about three rather grand categories. And the first of these is the role of the leader as an integrator. And basically, in this respect, what is happening here is a person who simply pulls together that which already exists. This is the type of person who is not necessarily self-productive, not necessarily creative, or anything of the sort. This is a person who is tying together that which the group is in attempting to do. This will, in many ways, perhaps be the role that you will assume or ought to assume as the pastoral counselor in the Walter League. But in this respect now, what you are doing, you notice, as an integrator, you are not, and we'll talk about the next two, a vocalizer or a reformer here. What you are doing is interpreting the social norms of the group and helping the group accomplish something with that which they have. You are a tier together. I noticed this morning in the chapel that they have the V-beams, or whatever you call them, rafters, I suppose, those heavy beams go up to the ceiling, that they have these tie bars that go across. Perhaps this is the way in which you can think of yourself as an integrator. In this respect, you have your group, which represents a certain particular social, religious, spiritual, cultural point of view. But frequently you find that this group is not totally uniform in what it attempts to do or in the carrying out of its particular attitude. If it were, you would have this type of thing with your line of progression down here. But this is a mighty rare instance. In fact, remember that was that ideal situation. As a result, you get this. And possibly you might have more type of thing. As an integrator, you serve as that one that reaches across all the way, pulling the group together and holding it together. Now, pulling and holding it together not on the basis of sheer power that you absolutely demand that somebody get in line, that you force them in line by dint of your authority in the congregation, but pulling them together in terms of the cultural point of view of the group itself. Literally, not letting the group just run off at loose ends. Now, we'll talk a little bit more about this later. The second one would be that of the vocalizer. The vocalizer is another type of leader. The vocalizer is perhaps the most sensitive type of leader that there is. In many respects, by the way, this is the category into which we would put union officials. Union officials are extremely sensitive to what the thinking is among the union members. And on the basis of being very sensitive to this, using in a certain sense an attitudinal stethoscope, they will pull together and set up a given program. In this respect, all that they are doing is either putting on paper or putting into words that which the group already feels. This is the vocalizer. And incidentally, the vocalizer is a person that can always look good. I come out here, I'm asked to speak before getting up before the group, maybe this morning. Mill around with the group and see, how do you feel about Walter League? So just without asking this question directly. And perhaps in the course of talking with most of the group, or at least touching here and there, I find that there seems to be a prevailing sentiment
that this whole business of Walter League is strictly for the birds. So, now as I get up to speak then, you see, I am very careful not to push Walter League too hard on you. So I use this type of approach. Now this business of Walter League, it's a good idea, and it's certainly got a lot of good things that can be said for it. However, I think we ought to bear in mind that there are also other points of view that are quite possible. See, what I'm doing is I have perceived your feelings, and I am playing them back to you. I am playing them two ways. Number one, the man over there represents Walter Lee, so I play to him. Certainly there's something to be gotten out of Walter. However, before you leave me, I want to emphasize that, of course, a lot of this stuff has to be taken with a grain of salt. Now, this is the type of leader that is leading but not directing the group. The vocalizer is indeed a leader and is followed and supported by the group as long as that person vocalizes the felt needs and the sentiments of the group. The third type, and you notice here we have some rather opposing groups. Now we can put the second type on either. The third type is the reformer. This is the person whose intent and purpose now is to change the group. Change the group in two ways. Change the group in terms of its direction of action, and change the group also in terms of its attitude. Change the group both mentally and physically in the sense of activity. Now, of course, this is the position that you will have to a great extent as a pastor. In terms of education, in terms of evangelism. You see, in evangelism, you are not playing on the people. At least if you're a Christian pastor, you're not. You are not playing on the people in terms of what they as people would like and what they as people presently feel. See, this is just feeding the stop back to them again. But as a Christian pastor, you have the responsibility of assessing who are these people, what are these people, and then very literally reshaping them in terms of their attitude and in terms of their line of action. Now, as you work with groups, especially with regard to Walter League here, you're going to have to cover all three of these types. And this is where you have a tremendous difficulty before you. After all, your Walter League kids are not total boobs. These are Christian young people. These are Christian young people who are trying, but every so often get off in a wrong direction. As Reverend Clouser said this morning, not necessarily the nastiest kind of heresy, but good heresy. So what you do is not jump on them and say, "You dirty little heathen, you've got 30 days to repent." But what you do is pull them together. This is the integration, where on the basis of their already existing Christian spiritual frame of reference, you pull them in. You've drifted off the path a little bit. You also have a responsibility as a vocalizer, perhaps most so in this respect. Average age graduating from the SEM, 27, 28, something like 25? 22? All right. Those who had the strips and the ponies at 22 and the rest at 25. All right, we'll say at 25. Now, think just for a moment. What's going to be the average age of your Walter Leaguer? Now, let's exclude for a moment those who, in certain respects, are still with the league because of one or more reasons that have prevented them from establishing their own marital league. But what is going to be the average age of your Walter League? You'll probably be working with a lot of people 15, 16, 17 years old. From the time that you begin, you've got 10 years on them. Now, unless you want to say that in that additional 10 years you haven't learned a thing, you haven't picked up anything, you haven't been aware of any additional experiences, if you're willing to admit that, well, then you'll just have to take what goes with it. But if you want to take any other point of view with regard to yourself, which is much more accurate,
then you're going to have to recognize this, that there is a tremendous difference between your 15 to 18-year-old leaguer and you as the counselor operating with, well, let's put it this way, 25-plus, even after you just, counselor and pastor, just get out into the ministry. And this is where, as a vocalizer, you have to be very careful. You will have the responsibility as a vocalizer to determine what is this group thinking and feeling? What would it like to do? There's a big difference between this and what would I, as a pastor, ideally like to have the group do. And I suppose this comes into the general area, excuse me, I keep forgetting it, in the general area of perception. Recently, our group served as a research consultant with regard to a study of This is the Life as a television show. You can approach a study such as that from four different points of view: the message, the presentation of the message, the perception of the message, and the reaction to the message. We concentrated on the perception of the message. Now, this is what we're talking about here. If I were to speak to you the gospel, auf Deutsch, which is not a very reasonable possibility, but at any rate, would you be hearing the gospel? Would it be coming to you? First of all, would there be gospel? Would there be a presentation? Yes. But because of certain cultural blocks, you would not be, perhaps I should say here, receiving the message. Now, this is a very gross illustration. Now, let's refine it somewhat in this respect. Let's suppose now that you all have certain very strong feelings about brush cuts. You have very strong feelings about them, either pro or con, but the feelings are quite strong. I talk to you about haircuts, emphasizing, and suppose I present it this way, the adult mature haircut, if you still have hair, is the longer cut. Now, how many of you would be receiving this message, or perceiving? All of you, I think we say. But how many of you would be accepting this message? Those who found it comfortable and convenient with your already established attitudes with regard to haircuts. And this is the thing you're going to have with regard to your Walter League, too. That you're going to have to be careful, now let's turn it all the other way around, that you as pastor and counselor do not see the desires and the interests of your league through the colored glass of your own desires and interests. It's your own desire and interest that the Walter League, perhaps because of personal experience, every year put on a play for one reason or another. So you go to the league and you say, what do you think about this, gang? That the Walter League puts on a play here. Nothing. Finally, somebody thinks, well, we better say something. Not a bad idea. And because you are already so overwhelmingly convinced yourself, you say, fine, Mr. Chairman, what do you say we appoint a committee and get started on this? And you push it through. You will probably have a play, but in the course of putting this on, you're going to experience a fantastic amount of apathy. You're going to get disgusted. You're going to be chewing the kids out. You'll probably come up ending up saying something like this: look, do you want this play or don't you? And of course, that's probably what you should have thought of many months ago. The point is, they didn't want it. And a single little pipsqueak from the middle of the league felt that since the pastor asked the question, I'd better say, yes, that's a nice idea. And the pastor, already convinced in his own mind, snowballed this pipsqueak into what he felt was overwhelming approval. Now, this is where you'll have to be careful as a vocalizer, that you do not read yourself into your teenagers or see your teenagers as you would like to see them. This works both positively and negatively, by the way. If you have had on your vicarage, and let me ask you, please raise your hands, how many of you had occasion to work rather intimately with Walter Lee during your vicarage? Well, most of you then. Now, let me ask you very frankly, how many of you had at least one or a number of unpleasant, unhappy experiences with the Walter League? All right. Now, this is the group that perhaps has to be have the greatest concern as a vocalizer. Your experience, the fact that you're willing to shoot your hand up immediately, indicates that you have had some and a rather impressionable, unhappy experience with Walter Lee. You have the possibility, and perhaps you should say the danger, when you start again, of reading into the next league that you work with the present unhappy attitude that you have toward league work. I'll tie this all together in just a second. This reformer idea. Remember, your Walter League is composed, theoretically, of Christians. But there's this matter of Christian growth. And where Christian growth is concerned, you have within the individual the constant conflict of man and God, of the Holy Spirit and Satan, this old tug of war within the individual. And many times you're going to find within the league, within the congregation too, for that matter, but we're centering on the league here, that what's going to happen is that you have a fine individual, as far as a leader goes, a responsible person, and so forth, but this guy is way off in left field, maybe on this worship business. That when he reads a prayer, what was the thing that Pastor Clouser was looking for here, some Pelagian prayers or something of the sort, that what you're going to have to do is literally reform this fellow with regard to prayer life. Or possibly this is a fine Christian young man. He's elected chairman of the group. But once he becomes chairman and picks up the gavel for the first time, it's sort of power mad in the group, see? And in this respect, as a counselor, you're going to have to reform and reshape. But remember, still allowing that person to be leader. As a counselor, you have to tie together, you have to feel the group. You have to reform the group, but always remaining a counselor of the group. And not the dictator of the group. And this is where the greatest difficulty comes. Now, I am not saying here that as a counselor leader that you should not make definite statements. I'm not emphasizing any non-directive type of counseling. This can bog down tremendously, too. You have to maintain a balance here. But you've got to bear in mind these things. Now, let's look at some of the factors in leadership and take a specific example here. And a specific example that I would like to use is the example of charismatic versus institutional leadership. Now, you're acquainted with the idea of charismatic, of charisma, of a gift. The charismatic leader is the one who maybe can't tell you what he does, why he does it, and yet every time he steps to the rostrum of the Walter League as president, he just always does the right thing. This is the leader that seems somehow or other to have a certain gift for rallying people around him. The type of thing that we speak of when we say a born leader. The institutional leader is the one who, by contrast, has developed and very carefully nurtured and trained himself for this particular position. I suppose we could contrast the two also in this respect if we wanted to use an educational thought connected with it. The charismatic person is a person that for one reason or other, we won't worry about why, is just born with the ability to handle the most complicated problem in nuclear physics. The institutional type of person is the one who can also handle this type of complicated problem, but on the basis of much schooling, preparation, so forth, and experience. Now, this is the type of thing that we get. An institutional leader is one that is established by fiat. For example, the birth of a king. A king is an institutional leader by birth. Well, take a queen, Queen Elizabeth. What did she have to do with becoming queen? She was just born queen. Another example that might be held is this here in the United States. The vice president taking over at the death of the president in the United States. For all intents and purposes, it's quite possible, and this has occurred in American history, that the person who was elected vice president was never ever thought of in terms of the presidency. That was the last position they may have wanted that person to hold. And yet, because of the death of the presidency, that individual automatically became president. This is an institutional leadership thing. Another example would be the Roman clergy in relation to the congregation, or the Methodist, for example, where the in the Roman church, where the bishop simply places this man in the congregation. Congregation has nothing to say about it. As far as the congregation is concerned, by an act of the bishop, this man is now priest of the congregation. And this is somewhat true also of Lutheranism. And this is somewhat going to be especially true with regard to your first call. Because as you well realize, many of your first calls, even where congregations are presently organized, established, were sent in with a blank space left for the name to be filled in. And all of a sudden, the congregation gets word back that John Schultz is going to be our pastor by our call. Though somebody else filled in John Schultz's name, he's totally unknown to the congregation. But by the act of a board of appointments, is it, whatever it happens to be, board of assignments, by this act, John Schultz is automatically, institutionally, the leader of this congregation. And this is a tremendously important thing. Now, think of a charismatic leader by contrast. And I think in the United States we had this situation in at the beginning of Eisenhower's second term. In a certain sense, the election was practically a formality. I said in a certain sense. This man was an institutional leader. He had been elected by vote and, in a sense, placed upon the whole country, even those who voted against him. Yet by the time of the second term, he had developed such a personal, emotional following, and certain attitudes had developed with regard to his leadership abilities, whether real or imagined, makes no difference, that this individual had become something of a, thought of almost as a divinely appointed leader of the country. You find that also in this respect. How about the case of Jesus, where the Jews wanted to make him a bread king? This is a case where there was this emotional attachment to Christ. Selfish emotion, I'll grant you, but there was this emotional attachment to Christ, and they wanted to set him up as a bread king. On the basis of what formal degree from a bakery college did he have? All they knew was, this guy fed us once, and I now feel good. And this is the man for king in the future. This emotional push behind the fellow. Now, this is the difference between the institutional and the charismatic leader. Now, it is possible for the institutional leader to enslave the structure beneath him. For instance, if we have the institutional leader here, it is possible for him to literally enslave, blanket, everybody beneath him. Why? Because he is there by authority. For example, it would be possible within certain limits for Eisenhower, as an institutional, as a voted leader, elected leader, to enslave the people of the United States, barring rebellion and so forth. Because as president, he has been given, you see, an institutional power, which he can use, conceivably, for his own devious ends. This is not true of a charismatic leader. A charismatic leader leads only as long as those who follow feel he still has the gift. You can lose it pretty easy. Now, the institutional leader has this problem, that unless he allows those who are beneath him some redress, he's going to have revolution on his hands. What would be what's the smartest thing for the Russians to do in terms of the satellite? Let the satellites rule themselves in front of the curtain. Let the people have elections. After all, it amazes me that the Russians haven't thought of this, well, perhaps they have. Why not have completely free elections in East Germany? Run all kinds of candidates, pro-Russian, anti-Russian, everything. Just make sure you count the ballot. Say it sure was close. But the pro-Russian man eats out of history. I mean, give the people the redress of a vote, of a formal choice book as opposed to
just a blank ballot or a one-name ballot. This is something you've got to remember in your lead, too. This is something... This is something also with regard to the congregation. As the pastor and as the called pastor of the congregation, you have a responsibility to exert your authority, theoretically your knowledge and ability, toward the furtherance of the spiritual welfare of those people. And sometimes this means using your institutional authority. Sometimes this means telling some of your people, now look, I'm pastor of this congregation, either or. But don't forget that you use this only in the most extreme instances. Because there is, unless you give the people an opportunity to come back at you, including room for criticism. Remember, criticism doesn't always have to be nasty. You run the risk of losing them. For after all, what's the simplest way of cutting off a leader? What? Oh, no. I mean, this theoretically can be prevented. Yeah, either passive resistance or a more extreme form, everybody commits suicide. Just cut yourself off. Just an illustration, you don't advocate it. Now, this is why, let's take the business of sermonizing. When you step into the pulpit, what do you expect from your people? You expect attentiveness, serious consideration, and within limits, acceptance of the message that you bring to them. I said within limits. You can push this too far. For instance, here's a little gimmick that is frequently used. Allow your people each year an anonymous evaluation sheet. A checklist, yes, no, undecided. This is done, and I have a man who works with me at Trinity here today. This is done at Trinity. Every year we do this in a different area of the church, of our congregation's work. The one couple, I guess it was a year ago, we sent out this. In terms of the sermon, would you please check off your feeling with regard to the following question? Do not sign your name. And a stamped self-addressed envelope was included. Such questions as this. Does this pastor speak too rapidly? Yes, no, undecided. Does he use too many big words? Yes, no, undecided. Does he use too many illustrations? Do the illustrations seem to fit the sermon? Do the sermons make sense? Do you leave the church with a sense of having gained something from the sermon? And the people check these all off. Now, it's my privilege, too, don't forget, to keep this thing going with those questionnaires. But this is a way in which the people have an opportunity to get some of this feeling, if they have it, of being stifled off their chest. This is the redress thing. Now, I'm not telling you that what you ought to do is use a phony type of thing. What I'm indicating is simply that you have to allow a certain kickback, an equal and opposite reaction. Let's take a look at this approach to this question of charismatic and institutional leader within the law. And let's just suppose, for the sake of illustration, that here you have the institutional leader, and here you have the charismatic leader. There's 0 to 100, 100%. This is the way it would follow if you were going to relate formal education to types of leadership, roughly in this way. In other words, if you are an institutional leader only, that is, if you are the type of person whose leadership is accepted only because of your position, you're the most dislikable, there is such a thing, the most dislikable type of person there is, but you are accepted in the congregation and in the league only because of your position as pastor, then you had also better be the guy who can flaunt the highest kind of education. If you are the type of person that is just beloved of everybody, like a shaggy dog, then it's possible for you to be an overwhelming success in terms of relationships in the congregation and in your league with no education, or with nearly none.
theoretically, on the basis of a personality evaluation, a rather thorough one, and I would add a psychoanalysis, it would be possible to predict how much education you need to function in the parish adequately. Now, there's variations here, adequately as a minister. However, this is difficult, it raises an awful lot of questions, and so all of you receive a blanket training. What I'm saying is that some of you will stumble into the parish and through no fault of your own, but by the grace of God, will begin working with the people. You don't know nothing about leadership or the principles of group work. But again, like this lovable shaggy dog, you just get along beautifully, see, with practically nothing. Others of you, and I think this is where you ought to start looking, in fact, it's tragic that it's so late in your preparatory work, ought to look very seriously at yourself in terms of your personality. I'll give you a very simple and seemingly rather foolish question, but it's quite significant. Have I got it or ain't I? What kind of a guy am I? How do I function with people? How am I received by people, personality-wise? I'll tell you right now, if you're weak on this end, and some of you doubtlessly are, you're going to hold your people only by emphasizing this additional formal training. Some of you who are very strong on this end are going to be able to hold your people, even though you don't know much at all. And of course, our next step then is into this stewardship question. Let me look at it this way. Here you are as a pastor. Let's say 50% charismatic leader, 90% institutional leader, way up here. Okay? And here is the president of your Walther League. This guy's never been president of anything before. Institutionally, he has no training. But boy, is this guy strong over here in terms of charismatic leadership. You're going to have trouble. You're going to have trouble with this guy because he draws more of an emotional has more of an emotional attraction than you do. And be very careful of challenging this guy on the basis of your formal education and training. Well, now, George, you don't understand it. I've taken a lot of courses in this area. This neither impresses George nor those who are emotionally attracted to it. What you're going to have to do, and this is what I would suggest, is you can't beat them, so why not use them? Use this guy. This fella is a very lovable goof. And potentially he can be a wonderful leader for you. You provide this guy with a general frame of reference, and he'll sell any program to your league. Now, I know that to some of you this perhaps sounds rather Machiavellian, but that's the way the ball bounces. I mean, if you're going to go out with a completely naive view into the world that all people are 100% instilled with the love of God in them, well, it isn't going to last too long, I'll tell you that. What was the comment of Pastor Westling this morning? A kind word, but a gun type of thing? I'm not advocating the gun, but I would advocate this, that be aware of the fact that there are a lot of people with guns, a lot of different kinds of guns. Now, we spent quite a bit of time on this. I'd like to show you a couple others following the same pattern, but much more quickly. And this is a factor in leadership. And that's competence versus incompetence. Now this runs again as the other one. This time I'll put it on a continuum. At the one end of the continuum, we have absolute competence, which again is an ideal. At the other end, we have absolute incompetence, which fortunately for the church is also an unrealized ideal. Now what we have to consider here is that you as leader, now remember, as institutional leader, those kids never asked for you as pastor. They had no vote in a voters' assembly that sent out that blank call. And yet here you are all of a sudden as the church's gift to them. You are going to have to give evidence. You are going to have to give them evidence of being, in their view, adequately at home in this work. If you can't, you're going to lose them as leader. And when you begin to feel them slipping as leader, the reaction frequently is, or the response frequently on the part of the pastor is, no, come on now, let's go. I have this horse around here, all right? Pardon me. You shot it right there, boy. Because what happened is you felt yourself somewhat slipping. And feeling yourself slipping, you've attempted to bolster yourself by re-emphasizing your institutional position. As pastor, it isn't nice to tell you to take a flying jump in a lake. But this is the desire of the group. You have shot yourself as far as institutional leadership is concerned, and you do not have any charismatic leadership to fall back on. You've got to give evidence of being adequately at home in this particular area. Now, give evidence from whose point of view? Theirs, Lord, not yours. The easiest thing to do is be impressed with your own ability as you see yourself. It's what the group thinks of you. This may mean a number of things. This may mean that perhaps you're going to have to sit down with the kids and say, look, with your executive board, let's just talk about this business of serving as elected leaders in a group. What does this involve? And in the course of teaching them, in the course of talking with them, you also indirectly give them the impression, see, I'm really surprised. The pastor knows a lot about this. I just never thought of him particularly as a Walter leader, and yet he knows this stuff. This is a subtle, indirect way of handling this. Another consideration that you'll have to take cognizance of is this question of efficiency versus ineptness. Now, we've contrasted already efficient and effective. And the situation that you've got here, you're going to have to give evidence of efficiency as a counselor. Because even if young Jimmy Jones, as president, booms up the whole meeting, doesn't call emotions and staggers along verbally, as a result the meeting drags on and on and on and on, who's going to take the lap for the dragged out meeting? Probably you more than young Jimmy. Because Jimmy, you see, is already a part of the gang. And one of their exhibitions of his being in the group was that they appointed him or elected him president. He's already their path. You aren't necessarily. You see, again, this is what we were saying in terms of institutional leader. You're their pastor, but they don't necessarily have to like it. They have to recognize it, but not like it. And you've got to work on both ends. The solid pastor is the one who is most adequately prepared intellectually, institutionally, and he was most solidly beloved emotionally. This guy is almost impossible to dislodge him. This is the type of individual, you've heard this said sometimes, that could preach to the whole group over here and say, now we will all run and take a flying leap off the dock. And everybody does. Giving no thought, now this is extreme, giving no thought to this at all. Why? Two things. I love that man, and I know he loves me. If he says so, it's for my welfare, charismatic. Institutionally, furthermore, that man's got the know-how, the training. I respect his training. I'll go along with him. You've got to consider also this. Perception versus imperception in a leader. And this is a perception of the culture of the group. I would suggest that the first thing you do when you get into a congregation, and I'll pick this up a little later at the end, is that you spend the first month with your big mouth shut and your eyes and ears wide open. And notice there are four of them and only one of these. Take a good look at the community you are going to work. Take a better look at the people you are going to work with. Notice I said work with, not work. Get to know what kind of people are these. What is their line of thought? Let's take a real simple thing. Are these basically laborers or are these basically businessmen? Are these people who enjoy a surplus economy, certain luxuries within the home? Or are these the people that just barely keep their nose above water? This is going to influence their total reaction, their total action within the church also. Are these people here? Are these people born Lutherans? Or are these converts? What's the age of these people? What's happened in this community in the past several years? Has this community suddenly become a suburban adjunct of a larger city, where 10 years ago, when most of these people were living, when a great number of these people were still living here, was this basically a sleepy little hollow? This is a perception thing. This is true also with regard to your Walter League Society. What kind of kids have you got in the society? Have you got the kind of kids who are accustomed, because of their family cultural background, to heterosexual relations, to dating back and forth, and are relatively smooth in terms of escorting a girl, in terms of dating procedures and the like? Or have you got the type of kids who, because, again, of cultural background, have actually proceeded physically beyond the time when they usually start heterosexual relations, but never learned how to get into them, and so sort of stumble along here in terms of sexual social relations? This will make a tremendous difference within your society. This is a perception thing. How well do you know the group with which you are trying to work? Another consideration is a recognition of the group structure and of the members, as opposed to soloing. We're referring back here to the social structure of the group, the elected authority, the chain of command, and so forth. To what extent do you, as counselor, fit yourself into that chain of command as a part of it, somehow or other? To what extent do you, as counselor, stand as a solo figure? It's the Walter League and its officers and me. You see, in a sense, what you do is invite the attitude on the part of the group that you are not a part of the group, which is actually true. Another consideration is creativity and imagination versus fixed routine. These are all the things that influence, I'm sure I mentioned this before, that influence leadership and the acceptance of a leader. It is not necessary that you, as a counselor, as a leader in the congregation or in the community, be the type of fellow that every time a voters' assembly meets has a brilliant new idea, never heretofore conceived of within the Holy Christian Church. But you do have to be the type of individual that shows the existence of creative imagination.